Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 18th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Dave Crow. Today's session number is CRD 2001-03, and it's titled Norway as a Green Oil Producing Nation. Let's listen in.
To reintroduce myself to some of you and to introduce myself to others, my name is Dave Crow. I teach English at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And as I've just been telling you, I'm actually a Minnesotan and a Norwegian-American. I love the country of Norway, although my presentation is at least partly about things that it seems to me Norwegians could learn from us about. Much of what I'm talking about is what we can learn from the Norwegian example. What we've arrived at in the prior two sessions, actually I guess was summarized in a session earlier today. I wasn't there, but it sounds like it was summarized very well. One of the presenters was saying that in our lives, we've got a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. I've been talking about this in slightly different terms throughout the week. The horizontal axis is where we serve others. That's one of the things we do as Christians. We devote our lives to the service of others. That's one of the few sensible things we can do in our lives. The other thing we do is vertical, and that is relate to God, worship God. What I've been arguing all week is that Norwegians in their spiritual life seem to have placed tremendous emphasis on the horizontal, on service to others through their extensive welfare state and their general set of policies and their general way of life. But they have severely, is that the right word? They severely diminished the vertical, that is their relation to God in an overt way. As I told you yesterday, those of you who were here, only about 3% of Norwegians worship regularly, which seems a shockingly low number. The U.S. number is going to be above 40% for worshipers, and even much, much higher in terms of believers in a living God. So that's what we've been talking about so far. So the overarching theme through the week, we've just been gabbing about Norway part of the time, haven't we? And that's been fun too. But we've also been talking about just the Norwegian sense of stewardship for others. And today we're shifting the focus slightly to talk about Norwegian stewardship of nature, which seems a related kind of issue. I'm going to tell you stories about Norwegian politics and Norwegian social life today that I think that for most Americans, I assume most of you are Americans, citizens of the U.S., there was at least one Canadian with us yesterday, that these are sort of shocking stories. By the way, before we begin, I should point out some of the books I'm using in case you're interested, so interested in Norway that you might want to pursue these books. They have not been ordered for the bookstore here because they don't seem quite the right kind of book for this particular bookstore. They're not oriented around spiritual matters or religious matters, nor are they particularly geared to the topics I've been talking about. They're more sort of broad references on Norway. This one's called Living in Norway, A Practical Guide. Let's see what are the author's names. If you're particularly interested, Michael Brady and Belinda Drabble. And it is absolutely full of information, every possible thing you'd like to know, like what kinds of plastics you can recycle in Norway, and how you can buy a car, and what taxes you'll pay, et cetera, et cetera. It's an incredible amount of information here. Yesterday's material, especially on secularization, came from this book, Grace Davy, Religion in Modern Europe, which tells the story of how Northern Europe particularly has become so secularized. Although not all the countries, of course, Spain and Ireland particularly are not particularly secularized. And then finally, a very fine history of Scandinavia, really brief and really readable, by Tony Griffiths, titled simply Scandinavia. So if you're interested, you can come up and get those titles later, or you can talk with me about them, or consult your notes. Well, let's start with some scripture. I did actually use our bookstore today to get this bit of scripture to relate to the topic for the day. I'm looking here for a scriptural calling for this stewardship of nature that we're talking about here. And a prayer book I picked up this morning suggested Isaiah 24, 4 through 5, 4 and 5, as a possible example. Let's see if you agree that it works. The verses go like this. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Now that scripture seems to imply pretty strongly that if you break covenant with God, that the natural world is laid waste. Any reaction to that verse?
Wow.
Yeah, it's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I want to just be fair about this. I want to say that it seems to me the verses are taken a bit out of context here. The beginning of chapter 24 goes like this. Now, the Lord is about to lay waste the earth and make it desolate, and he will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the slave, so with the master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, on and on. In other words, the laying waste of the earth is actually caused by God as punishment. It doesn't say necessarily that this is something we do in our sinfulness. Nevertheless, do you agree or not agree? I'm not sure how to take this verse. Clearly the verse links our sinfulness with the desolation of nature, and that makes good sense to me. I prefer to think about this calling in a slightly different way. I think I'd like to think about it in purely human terms, that how we relate to each other rather than how we relate to nature. Nature is related in this sense. Selfishly abusing and greedily overusing our natural world is a sin against our neighbor, including our future neighbor, the generations who come after us. That seems to me maybe a slightly more sound way of thinking about our Christian responsibility toward nature. Reaction?
When you define pollution in the Bible, I didn't even know they had that word then.
Yeah.
Does it mean the same thing as now?
I've got a strong suspicion that in this verse it doesn't mean the same thing, because I don't think the forces were in place 2,000 years ago for the concept of pollution as we understand it today. I don't think it could be understood in quite the same way. Yeah, go ahead.
I do think that the Palestine area has been subject to over-harvesting and over-grazing and has had sort of ecological crashes many times in recorded history.
Yeah. Right. So at least the exhaustion of soil is something they would have been quite familiar with, if not pollution per se. Huh? Yeah.
Israel's just decimated from their forests that they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about the cedars of Lebanon and stuff, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, certainly over the last decades, we have laid waste to our world, haven't we? Now, the interesting thing about it, the next move I want to make in this presentation is to think a little bit about how Norwegians, as a people, do relate to their natural world and how it seems to differ from our own relation to nature. Or does it, I guess, is the question I want to ask. I may have overstated in my blurb for today the greenness of Norway. I just went to the New York Times 5 minutes ago, wasting time before you all showed up, and I was looking at an article on carbon dioxide emissions, and guess which nation leads per capita carbon dioxide emissions? Yes, it's us. 5 point something pounds per year of carbon dioxide for each U.S. citizen.
Tons, I think.
Is it tons? No, not per person, not per capita.
Yeah, I think it could well be tons.
I think it's tons.
Well, we better check the New York Times before we take off, because we ought to know this. I'll run and get it in a couple of minutes if I can think of an excuse. There were a list, I think, of 13 other nations, Sweden being second to last at 1.5 of whatever these units are. Okay, Sweden does quite well among industrialized nations. Number two on the list was, in fact, Norway.
And from the top or two from the bottom?
Two from the top, right after us, with 4.5, or something on that order. Something like 3 to 4 times what the Swedes put out, which is, I think, kind of shocking. So maybe I exaggerate the greenness of Norway, yet living there, my sense was that so many of the policies, many of which I'll talk about today, are oriented around a kind of stewardship of nature. Shocking that the third country on the list is actually the Czech Republic, and I would have put them at a much higher polluting rate than Norway if I had, you know, been able to guess about it, but so it goes. Well, what kind of situation do we have in Norway? What are the sort of material circumstances that we need to think through in order to make sense of this this picture? Well, this is a Norwegian phrase, olja og natur, and you can probably guess what it means, oil and nature. And those are the two factors that we weigh when we think about a country like Norway. This is going to raise some really interesting questions for comparison, I think. Here's the country of Norway again. You look at a nation and you sort of try to devise the logic that gave it those particular boundaries. You know, what kind of nation is Norway? How does it differ from Sweden next door?
It's seafaring.
Yeah, exactly. That's the logic. The logic of Norway is that this Arctic and subarctic coastline went to the Norwegian people. Right, and something more like prairie or grazing land and farming land went to the Swedes next door, with a bit of seacoast to the south. But what Norway is a coastal mountain range on the sea, basically. As I think I told you on the first day, only 3% of the country is arable. That's why half of Norwegians, probably one major reason why half of Norwegians moved to Minnesota, Wisconsin, Washington, and places like that in the 19th century. It's hard to grow enough food to sustain the people who live there. What are the industries then in Norway? What historically have been the industries in Norway? Shipping, fishing, hydroelectric, actually, more recently in the 20th century, and now, finally in the modern times, tourism and oil. Okay, now they're at war with each other, aren't they? Because for tourism in Norway, you want natur. You want the fjords to look pristine, the mountains to look beautiful, the water to run clear. And in fact, they've thought about that. Throughout the 20th century, when before oil was discovered in the 1960s, hydroelectric was the main industrial work of Norway, even ahead of shipping, because shipping had sort of faltered at this time. And the Norwegians had the foresight to build, two different kinds of hydroelectric plants. One is they build these great palaces next to the water with inlaid floors, and gorgeous decorating. I mean, really, literally, palaces of hydroelectric generating that you can now tour. They're gorgeous buildings. So that's one way that they sort of, you know, were stewards to their own views. But more recently, what they've done is they've actually built their hydroelectric into the rocks underneath the water, underneath the falls, so you don't see them at all. It's mostly a matter of tunnels going under waterfalls and taking the force of that water and generating it into electricity, so you simply don't see it. This is a question I'll be asking today. It comes to the matter of motive. Are they going to all this trouble because they're stewards of their ecology and they care deeply about nature in a general way, or are they doing it because they know that they've got a valuable commodity for tourism that they need to try to preserve? And I don't know the answer to that question. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I've traveled to Norway quite a bit, and one thing they're deathly afraid of is that the Norwegians have become like America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't want the plastic,
that's right.
The junk around.
That's right.
They want it tucked away.
That's right. I was going to fit this in sometime during this session, and maybe now is the time to do it. Remarkable how hard the Norwegians work to make sure that they do live a sort of untainted life. I mean, fruit juice for kids has absolutely no coloring in it. There's only one color of fruit juice. You don't get these vivid purples and deep reds that stain our carpets when we have small children in America. None of that. Everything is a sort of natural color. Cheese, you don't get a yellow cheddar cheese because they don't put any dyes in their cheese. It's almost all white cheese except for that Brunost stuff, right? Yeah. They're very finicky about additives and any kinds of impurities at all. You're absolutely right. Then we have to tell the story of oil. In the 1960s, the Phillips Petroleum Company was the first to, actually they're just making an educated guess, they're the first to guess that there might be oil and gas reserves in the North Sea, and so they requested permission from the Norwegian government to drill some exploratory holes, and when they drilled them, what did they find? Enormous, vast, fields of extremely high quality oil. The stuff coming out of the Middle West is supposed to be quite good, Middle East, excuse me. The stuff coming out of Norway is not, the fields aren't as large, but it's very, very high quality oil apparently. And so it's got, you know, it's valued on the world market. And Norway does in fact trail only Saudi Arabia in oil sales and oil production these days.
How long has that been?
1971 was the first offshore oil.
But since they've got to that level, where they're number two.
That I don't know. I think it's been only within the last decade or so that they've become the number two producer, because it was in the 80s that they really built some enormous rigs. I'll send some pictures around actually, so you can get an idea of this. These pictures are taken at and around the Oil Production Museum in Stavanger. And this is one of the reasons I went to the trouble of making this map today. Here's Stavanger here, and most of the oil industry is located right down here around that city.
Where's the North Sea on your map?
The North Sea, right here. All along the coastline is the North Sea. Yeah. And the Arctic Circle is right about here. So you're very, very far north. But remarkably, Bergen is much warmer than Davenport, Iowa. It was in the 40s most of the winter. It only snowed a couple times where the snow stayed for more than a few days. Mostly it just rained and rained and rained and rained and rained. But the North Sea has warm currents running through it, the Gulf Stream, that warms the coastline. But anyway, Stavanger here is the center of the oil industry, and that's where this oil museum is. And if you go up some of the local fjords in the Stavanger area, you can see some absolutely spectacular sights, because you'll go up these beautiful, pristine fjords. And you know what the fjords look like? These mountains just plunging down directly into the sea. And in them, you'll see production sites where the oil rigs are being built. These towering, huge things being built. Or sometimes old rigs parked there waiting to get repainted or just waiting to get salvaged or taken apart. It's really stunning. The museum.
These are the floating platforms. Right?
That's right.
They then pull out to the North Sea.
They're floated out. They've got dormitories and workshops and all kinds of other things planted on top of them. They tow them out into the sea. They partially flood the legs so that they sink. Some of them actually sit on the floor, sea floor. Others are just chained to the sea floor, and they pump oil from them. The workers go out and come in by helicopter. For the most part. This picture, which it has in the foreground one of the rescue boats that they use on board ship now, but also on the oil rigs, and in the background is a rig which I was told is the world's largest oil rig. It had been towed into Stavanger for work. They were going to take one dormitory off of it and put a new one on it to house a couple hundred people. Just amazing the kind of thing they're doing. So I'll start that here and pass it around. This is another older oil rig and much smaller, but it's a one that I wanted to take a picture of because it's adjacent to my mother's family's farm on a little island outside of Stavanger. So there we were on this farm, and two things shocked me when we got there. I was expecting a grassy little rocky farm in Norway, and that's what it was. But we also found these two stone obelisks from the Copper Age right on the property that we'd never heard about before. And then off in the distance, a 1970s oil rig. Talk about, you know, jangling images. So,
Dave, what's an obelisk?
Like the Washington Monument. A tower, a stone tower.
Like it was it for worship or
yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, it was actually. They were about as high as this room, maybe, and as big around as you could get your arms around, sitting next to each other.
Is it carved or?
These weren't, but there were carvings in the rocks down on the seashore, right in that same area, and those runes that people don't quite know how to read. You know, I mean, some of them look like ships and clearly are, but you don't quite know what they mean. Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. And this is one of my favorites. I had to take a picture of this, although it didn't reproduce very well. This is a little diorama from the oil museum that tries to explain in secular terms the story of the burning of the bush, the burning bush from the Bible. And it claims that, in fact, what that probably was a spontaneous fire caused by leaking petroleum products coming out of the ground. No, it's kind of a secular message, isn't it? Yeah, but I love that one. I thought, that's so Norwegian. You know, you got to explain away biblical myth as a natural process. But anyway, so these are the things that we have at war right now. Now, just as in Florida last week, isn't that right? The Norwegians are careful to keep the oil production over the horizon. So you don't see it. It's there, it's happening, but you don't see it. Okay, so we move on. Next, stop me and ask your questions or, yes, go ahead.
Are they selling oil rigs to other countries too?
They sell the technology. I'm not sure if they're selling rigs per se, but they've become expert at the technology. As I said yesterday, what has happened is the shipping industry was failing in the 1970s just as this oil industry came online, so the shipbuilders were reassigned into oil rig building. So it worked out really well.
Interesting too that the Norwegians have quite a technology in some of these areas. It was the Norwegian crew that finally opened that Russian submarine.
That's right. Yeah, they do have a great skill in this area. Although one of the things you find when you're in the Stavanger area is that many of the oil workers in the area are Americans and Brits. So it's a shared technology, it's an international technology, really. Yeah. Now we move on to this public sense of stewardship and its price. I'll tell you a couple of stories about this to give you a sense of how Norwegians feel about their environment and about their environment generally. When I moved to Norway, did you get it?
Well, I didn't know which New York Times it was. It's not all three.
It's the Friday one. Let's see.
Here's Friday.
Is Tuesday or Friday? Thank you. Thanks, Jeannie. In the interest of accuracy, we'll do this. Well, I thought it was a Friday one. Maybe it is the Tuesday one. I guess it is. Where is she? I think it is Tuesday, actually.
Tuesday?
Yeah, sorry. Where was I? Public sense of it. Yeah. When I arrived in Norway, the Prime Minister was actually a Lutheran minister. Did you know that the Prime Minister of Norway was a Lutheran minister? Yeah. For those of you who are Lutheran and care about these things, Kjell Magne Bondevik was the Prime Minister. Thank you. And I hope this is the right one.
I can look for it for you while you keep going.
Yeah, maybe that's a good idea. I thought it was, I don't know which one it is. One of the early pages.
I'll just look for it while you're talking.
Okay, it's something like Europeans upset with U.S. For pollution standards or something like that. Bondevik was in place not because his Christian Democrat Party had placed the largest number of members in the parliament, which is how you become prime minister, as you know. but was there because the Labour Party made kind of a crazy political move a couple years before. The Labour Party earns something like 36-40% of the vote in Norway routinely, and that means they keep the Prime Minister in place all the time. Almost all the time they have the majority party, and so they control the government. But in one election cycle, their numbers slipped enough that it was embarrassing enough to the party that the party leader said, all right, we're not going to lead this country anymore. We're going to allow a coalition government to be formed by the other parties. And they put forward Kjell Magne Bondevik as their leader for this coalition. It's crazy. And it's the only thing crazier than this is the Electoral College, of course. But anyway, that's how it works. And this is how the Bondevik government fell while we were in Norway during 1999-2000. Bondevik believed that the technology was available to start burning the vast holdings in natural gas that Norway has, and burning it so that Norway could be a little bit more self-sufficient with energy. A lot of Norwegian electricity, in spite of all the hydroelectric, comes from coal burning in Germany, and the electricity is brought in. Now, obviously, they're worried about that because Germany could stop that flow of electricity at any time, but they like it. This is one of the ironies of Norway as a green nation. Norwegians like this because, of course, the carbon dioxide that comes off the coal burning is going into German air rather than Norwegian air. You know. By the way, Norwegians also ship their garbage to be burned in Germany and Denmark for the very same reason. I hope those aren't my kids. They probably are. The Norwegian public, when Bondevik suggested that they could start burning natural gas with not too bad emissions, went into an uproar, absolutely resisted this idea. No, excuse me, it's Labour who was wanting to do this, and Bondevik was resisting, and he was saying, no, we're not going to burn natural gas until, and I've got it right now, until the emissions are kept under control. And he could have compromised on this and kept control of the government, but he was willing to actually let his government collapse rather than to let these greater emissions be placed into the air. And I thought that was really, really interesting. But even more interesting, how about this? I'll give you some other statistics that you'll find amazing. Gas, as I think I told you, gasoline in Norway costs about $6 per gallon. $6 per gallon. And you know how nervous we got when it started to approach $1.80, $1.90. I know what I live in Iowa but work in the state of Illinois. I know the state of Illinois immediately started considering reducing taxes on gasoline to try to keep the prices down and that sort of thing. So that now what are we back? I guess I paid quite a variety of prices on my way out here. I don't know about you. Something between $1.39 and $1.79 on my way out, I guess. You guys too? $6 a gallon in Norway. And this, I think you'll find an interesting story. I took it off the internet this winter. Labour used to fight lower gas prices. Norway's ruling Labour Party can expect full rebellion from its youth wing if they pursue a policy of reducing taxes on gasoline. The AUF demand a national plan for reducing pollution. Lower gas prices would signal a poor ecological policy and says Labour should leave simple solutions to the extreme right-wing party. Their argument. So the Norwegian youth not only accept $6 a gallon gas, but don't want any of those taxes lowered because of the polluting problem. Perhaps equally shocking, if you buy an automobile in Norway, you pay a tremendous amount of tax. I'll give you a couple of examples of this. A VW Golf in Norway costs 200,000 kroner, which is about $25,000, a VW Golf. The taxes on that automobile will be 90,000 kroner, or $11,250, or about half the value of the automobile. And that's modest tax because a Golf, as you probably know, is a relatively fuel-efficient car. A Ford Escort will cost 270,000 kroner, or $33,750, and the tax will be $16,375, right in the same ballpark. This is an interesting one. If you import a 1995, a used Jaguar with a big engine in it, you can expect to pay $150,000 for the used car. That's $18,750. But the tax on it will be 203,152 kroner, or $25,394, or, you know, what, 150% of the value of the car itself. Because it's a gas guzzler, because it's a big burner. And that's so interesting because, you know, if there's a country in the world where it makes sense to drive an SUV, it's probably Norway. You know, the roads are all like this and like this and around mountains. And, you know, it's not like we're driving across town. No, you don't see SUVs. They're just far too expensive in that country.
What would the attitude of your neighbors, envy or revulsion, if you were driving a Jaguar?
I don't think it would be liked. I don't think it would be fully accepted in Norway. Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
Based on that figure, taxes, is public transportation common then?
Yes, it is.
Or replace that?
Common but expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was able to get, you know, I didn't have a car in Bergen. I was able to get anywhere I wanted to go on public transportation. In fact, there was a bus line that came out in a loop from the center of the city out to my suburb, right past my house practically, and back in. But each ride on that bus cost $3. Yeah, it was like a cab ride, you know. And although I was able to buy a monthly pass that reduced, I think I was able to spend about $100 a month to ride the bus all I wanted.
Buses?
Pardon me?
Were they diesel buses?
Yep, diesel Volvo buses, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a good train that goes from Oslo to Bergen, of course, and many of the other cities are connected, if not by train, by these fast boats. They have boats that are sort of catamarans. They run on two sort of pontoons, and the inside looks for all the world like a 747. You know, padded seats, carpeting, beautiful layout, and the thing just cruises along up and down the coast. If you drive anywhere on the coastline, you drive for 10 miles and then you get on a ferry and cross the ferry and then you get off and drive for 5 miles and get on another doggone ferry and each time you get on a ferry it costs you $19 and by Norwegian tradition you have to eat ice cream when you're on the ferry, so it's kind of like Holden. After church you have to eat ice cream. In Norway you have to eat ice cream on the ferry.
The other thing, though, is that it keeps Norwegians walking and riding their bikes.
That's right, exactly.
And so, you know, they're the healthiest people because they have to walk and ride bikes because they can't be
you're exactly right.
Going back and forth to work.
We all lost weight and got in better shape in the year we were living in Norway. And the interesting thing is, very few Norwegians that I saw were avidly exercising. They're not jogging and running and that sort of thing, but just your daily life has exercise built into it. You're right.
You know, people 80, 90 years old, you know, ride a bike 7 miles to the grocery store, you know, that's nothing.
Yeah, it's a way of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is the ice cream included in the 19th?
No, it is not. It is not. But like everything else in Norway, there's exactly 12 items of ice cream that you can buy. They're the same 12 you get everywhere across the country, and it's what everybody has. There's a boat is, which is a boat-shaped ice cream. There's a kroner is, which used to cost a kroner, which now costs 14. And it's all on it goes. Other items from the internet, just quickly to reinforce this point. Oslo was suggesting this winter that cars built before 1989 might be banned on the roads because they were high polluters. They might just absolutely get rid of them. And then in a country where having studded tires is still common, they were banned in Bergen the year I got there because they were adding to the pollution, tearing up the asphalt and adding to the pollution. So there is stewardship, and as I'm trying to indicate, Norwegians seem to be willing to pay a high price for this stewardship, just as they pay a high price to make sure that there isn't poverty and runaway disease in their country. So I guess finally then we come to the question of motive. Is it national character? Is it a kind of secular attitude of do unto others? Is it protection of a valuable economic resource? What is it that encourages the Norwegians to live the way they do, and what can we learn from it, if anything? I'd be interested in hearing your opinions. Did the pictures make it this far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my parents were from Switzerland, so I can't speak of Norway. But their background was that they sing all the time, you know, on their ships and buses and everywhere you go. And all of their songs refer back to nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that just seemed to be part of my parents' heritage, was mm-hmm. to be involved with certain boulevards or parks. That was it. So I suspect Norway may have some of that.
Right. I think you're right. I think that attitude is an important one. And of course, I think we can safely say that a major American attitude has been that the land is there, something for you to exploit and use for economic
destiny.
Manifest destiny, yeah. Go ahead.
I think pride, it has a lot to do with how they take care of things.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, that they, you know, you could hardly take out of Norway now any old things that were, because the historical societies kind of preserve them, and they, you know, they preserve their buildings so mm-hmm. they stay, and there's a pride that they want things to stay good and nice.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And I think that has a lot to do with it.
They would never allow that ugly forest of restaurant and gasoline signs
that we
get on the outskirts of every one of our cities. They would never allow that.
No. They have just,
and their inner cities are not blighted. You simply don't find those neighborhoods that are closed down that need to be renewed. You just don't see them. Yes.
Not directly related, but somewhat, is the when Tokyo was their opening ceremonies for the Olympics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was so much involved children and folklore as compared to some of the extravaganzas, you know, seem to have.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, aren't American halftime shows getting just ugly? They're getting that so out of hand, I can hardly watch them anymore. But yeah, there is that. The emphasis on children's safety, that's a Norwegian attitude to the core. Go ahead.
I was just curious about as far as alcohol and drug usage and stuff like that. I know fuel and alcohol or whatever are really taxed high. But
yeah.
With that standard of living, is that also is abuse of those things?
It's growing and growing. You know, in the early 20th century, alcoholism was a huge problem in Norway, and now they've just begun to curb it somewhat, but now it's rising again because affluence in Norway is rising again. You know, the solution for that problem is a bizarre one when you go to live in Norway. Do you know what a vin monopoly is like? That's what a liquor store is in Norway. It's called vin monopoly, which means wine monopoly. And it looks like a bank. You walk in, it's carpeted, there's a counter there, you come in and take a number, you page through a little catalog, which has a fantastic selection of wines and booze. Unbelievable. And then you take your ticket when your number comes up to the counter, and you tell them what to go get you, and they bring it to you there. You're not allowed to touch the bottles until you own them. It's really strange. But it's a way of the government sort of keeping a lid on the whole thing.
Now, how about smoking?
I'll get to that in just a minute. Yeah, that's a good question. But the other thing about booze is that, you know, a $10 bottle of gin in Norway, I'm a gin drinker, is going to cost $35 or $40. Mm. It's incredible. Wine, not quite such a markup, but more like double the price. Yeah. Cigarettes, a dollar per cigarette. And yet Norwegians smoke like crazy, especially college students, university students.
Are they making their own cigarettes or do they import them?
I think they're imported. I'm pretty, I'm sure they're in the
States. The old timers roll them.
Yeah? Is that right?
They, wherever I was, they spoke and spoke, but they rolled, you know, it was just like the Bull Durham sack and rolled their, had their papers and rolled it, you know, they spoke.
Uh-huh.
But I think the thing about alcohol in Norway is how they deal with driving. You know, you, the first time you're stopped and you have alcohol content, you don't have a driver's license.
Right, anymore. You lose your license. And you have to go into a re-instruction program.
You have to go, you know, there's no
that's on
second
the first violation.
First violation.
And also your first violation isn't 0.8 or whatever it is.
No,
it's an extremely low. That's why, as I said yesterday, we, you know, we're used to inviting people to our house and offering a glass of wine with dinner, and the driver would turn down even that first glass of wine, even though they knew they're going to be there for 3 or 4 hours.
This cannot.
No, they're very, very serious.
Yeah,
I think you're next, and I'll go to you next.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Do they have enough cows to produce their own milk, or they import milk?
No, they actually, it has been a struggle, but they've actually gotten to the point where they can supply their own dairy needs, and the milk and cheese is fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's really great.
So they have enough cows and feeding for the cows to do that.
Yep, they can do that. They can graze. That's one of the things they do that.
Go ahead. I'm just curious about what's happened to the whaling industry in Norway, because I remember at a time when it was, you know, very significant.
It's a modest industry now, but like the Japanese, the Norwegians are adamant that this is part of their national character, and they're going to keep whaling, even though the rest of the world keeps asking them not to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We ate whale one day. You can buy it in these enormous cubes, and it looks like red meat.
It is red meat.
Well, it is red meat, and that's how you prepare it. Any way you prepare
it looks
beef.
Looks like roast beef.
Yeah, we made kind
tastes
of a...
like roast beef.
We fried it up with onions. It was fantastic. It was so delicious. It didn't taste like fish at all.
Is it fat?
No, it's lean. No, it's lean. It's nice. We ate reindeer, too, which the kids loved. Go ahead.
It sounds like there are tremendous revenues from taxes, and I know there are tremendous revenues from... the oil fields.
Right.
Where does most of it go? Into the social services?
Yes. A lot of it goes into the taxes go into the social services. The oil revenue, they're mostly sitting on. It's a huge reserve that they're sitting on because they're deathly afraid of inflation if they allow that, if they allow those funds into the economy. And so, you know, it isn't changing the character of the country too much yet, but it sure changes the attitude of the people about fiscal matters, because they know they're sitting on literally hundreds of billions of dollars, or kroner. You know, just think what a sense of safety it would give to us if we were sitting on that kind of reserve. And I think we'd have universal health care right now, wouldn't we? You're next.
I was going to say, when you asked about the cows, they have bred their cows to be small and eat a small amount of feed, but huge milk producers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you know, we holler here about genetics and stuff, but they've been doing it for years.
Yeah, that's right. And the food in Norway is so interesting because, you know, they just almost refuse to bring in these great, big, glorious, shiny apples that we always buy. And you buy a Norwegian apple, it's a tiny little gnarly looking thing, but it's so delicious, you know, because it's homegrown. Go ahead.
Where do they invest their oil money?
Back into the, a lot of it goes back into the industry so that they've got, you know, frontline equipment. But I mean, most of it, I think, is just held in reserve. I mean, I think it's in the bank. It's making money.
Yeah, it's invested.
Go ahead.
Do they have a refining capacity, or is the oil all?
No, I don't think they do much refining. I think it's just production and sales for the most part. Yeah. That's a good question. There is a company that produces gasoline, Statoil, it's called. But I don't think they do too much refining. I mean, some.
Where is it done?
I don't know, actually. I don't know.
They import in the gasoline.
They may import. I know they import some gasoline because a lot of American brands are there.
I see.
Yeah.
What do the
they do about oil pollution, and what do they do about these rigs? I understand they very often go down around the world.
Occasionally, anyway, yeah. They have had very few major tragic accidents, although one rig did go down in a storm and I think 130 people were killed. But I don't recall reading about any major cleanup issues. The rigs, as you probably know, are over 100 miles offshore of the actual country. So even though they're in Norwegian waters, they're well away from the coastline. I don't know, I guess, much more about it.
The fishing industry hasn't been affected by
that? No, it hasn't. No, the fishing industry has only been affected as it has in Canada, for instance, and along the east coast of our country, by overfishing. As you probably know, the cod have practically disappeared.
Do they have a lot of forests in Norway and lumber industries?
Yeah.
That's been back from Oregon. It's a big issue there.
Yeah.
Foresting. How have they dealt with that in terms of the environment?
I think what they do is they limit production. I mean, there is forestry, or there is, what's the right word for it?
Logging.
Logging. There is logging going on, but they limit it pretty severely. And so that you almost never see forests that have been affected by logging. You almost never see it.
Relatively, there is a forester. If you have a plot of land out here in Norway that was in pine, you wouldn't have the right to cut that pine.
Yeah.
It would depend upon getting a permit from the government.
Right.
And the forester then acts almost like a county agent.
Yeah.
Distributing money to you to maintain the forest and also to do certain cuttings and trim whatever. So it's a very, very managed. You don't
One of the things you experience when you're there is that the entire economy, it really is a socialist enclave. I mean, the government is basically controlling the means of production for almost everything, including oil. It's all managed carefully. And the government also manages other things that you may find interesting. I guess I was thinking of talking about some of these things tomorrow. But, for example, you can camp anywhere you want in Norway as long as you're 100 yards away from a private dwelling. So there's no such thing as private property in a sense. You can walk across someone's property, you can camp on it, you can do anything you want. Except come within those few hundred yards. Go ahead.
There was a picture recently in the Christian Science Monitor of the King of Norway's rowboat that sits on his leg for anyone to use. And he only asks that you put it back where you found it.
Is that right? Pretty interesting.
Are most churches built from wood in Norway?
Yes. Yeah, they are for some reason.
A certain style, right?
Yeah, a certain style. Actually, if you've been to North Dakota or Minnesota, it looks like most churches look like country churches in the Midwest. You know, that sort of upright white style with a big steeple on it. Yeah. We're just gabbing now, aren't we? We're sort of on topic. So I'll tell you this story. One of the most interesting churches we visited around Bergen actually had come from North Dakota. It was built by Norwegian immigrants and now brought piece by piece from North Dakota to Bergen to be set up on this island out there so that they could remember that there were people from the country who had gone and built churches in America. You know, so boy, the circle's coming around now, isn't it? You know, we've got Stav churches in North Dakota and North Dakota churches in Bergen.
What are some more personal experiences you had that you found interesting about their attitude toward nature?
All right, here's one. The wife and children of our best friends, our neighbors, would attend services when they were offered on Sundays half the time or so, and we were trying to go as regularly as we could. There's that tradition going on Sundays, but one thing that almost every Norwegian does on a Sunday is pack the day pack and get out and walk up the mountain. That's a ritual. In fact, you come to church. I was always dressed wrong in Norway because I'd dress casually for a dinner party at friends' homes, and they'd be in a jacket and tie. And I'd go to church in a jacket and tie, and everybody's wearing their hiking boots and their backpack because they go right out the door from church, those who go to church, and go right up the mountain. And we'd go up the mountain and we'd roast hot dogs or we'd cook pancakes on rocks and freeze. And then down we'd come in the mud, go home for the day. Yeah, that was one experience. Boy, I could, tomorrow, by the way, is meant to be a funny day. And I will be talking about more of these kinds of personal issues. Yeah, go ahead.
As I said, talking about the oil and polluting, I've never seen a place that is so focused on safety.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever hear of a car getting hit by a train on a railroad crossing because they don't, the tracks and the roads are never constructed that way, so think you could have, and for a kid to fall on a track, it just isn't possible.
No, no, you're right.
I never saw such safety, and they're just safety, safety.
Actually, there was a huge boat sinking and train wreck while we were in the country, and it was interesting to watch these tragic things happen, because the television announcers, as they announced the news for the day, would cry. They'd openly weep, tears running down their faces as they'd tell about this boat sinking and children drowning in the North Sea, or a train wreck in which people burned to death. Uh-huh. I mean, they really deeply felt it. And then there was a murder of two little girls, actually rape and murder of two little girls in southern Norway in the last month we were there. And again, people were so stunned by it, they could hardly believe it, because they think these things do not happen in Norway. And in fact, people, I found this a little, well, I shouldn't find it offensive because it's true, but people would say to me, these things happen in America, they don't happen in Norway. And actually, somebody accused us of being calloused. We, those of us who are Americans in the room, they accused us of being calloused. Well, we live with these horrors every day, and so we just shrug them off. And I said, I don't think that's quite true. I come from Minnesota, and Minnesota has almost exactly the same number of people in it as Norway does, 4.5 million. And if a little girl is raped and murdered in the state, we're all reading about it. And I think we're all caring about it. I don't think we've become quite as calloused as the Norwegians want to believe we are. But you're right, safety is such a huge thing. The road that goes from Oslo to Bergen and back, almost no four lane in it. It looks like a state park road. You know, barely wide enough for traffic meeting. And the speed limit is something like 45 miles per hour. And that's what road transportation is like in Norway for the most part.
How about TV?
They have their own channels, and now they're getting cable.
What kind of quality?
Most of it's American reruns. So poor quality. And there's porn on TV, which is different from us. If you buy that, we didn't buy that cable, as you can imagine. They do some local program that was really interesting, and in fact, they invented Survivor, you know, that show that I've never watched it, but they invented that concept, and it was picked up by American TV stations. Yeah.
I think one thing we need to remember, with only 3% of the land arable, husbandry for that land is far more important to that than it is in this country, where, you know, if you got a 100-acre farm, first thing you know, you got 2,000 houses on the farm.
Yeah. Yep,
that's
right.
Over there, you can't do that. And you've got to take care of the limited land that you have.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Why they're so attuned. That helps them to be attuned, I think, more to nature and what you can and cannot do to protect it.
I'm a farm kid, or rather a tractor salesman's kid, mm-hmm. or I was when I was a kid. And, is it really callousness toward nature that causes us to do the things we do in agriculture? Or is it economic pressure? I think economic pressure has a lot more to do with it generally.
I'm born and raised in the fruit land, so I agree.
Okay, all right. Well, I remember reading a Jane Smiley novel, 1,000 Acres. Have any of you read it by any chance? In which she sort of makes the claim that it is a kind of masculine selfishness and callousness that causes farmers to use chemicals on their fields. And frankly, I don't find that persuasive at all. I think it's much more complicated than that. Now, we could stand to change, and in some ways have changed, you know, no-till farming practices and that sort of thing. Go ahead.
Well, one thing that strikes me about what you're saying about this economic issues, I mean, how long has Norway been pretty much settled to the extent that it is now? I guess at least 1,000 years.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So the frontier's been gone a long time.
Right.
Frontier has been in this country as recently as, what, 100 years ago?
It closed in 1892, theoretically. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
If you mess up what you've got, you just go next door, there's some more.
Right.
Now, to see the other side of that, look at what's going on in South America, the Amazon Basin.
Right.
The land you use, which is because of the environmental, well, because of the biological situation there, a lot of the land is not terribly rich. You cut down some rainforest, you try to farm it, the land is set up to be rainforest. It's not set up to be agricultural land. It gets kind of, the soil goes bad in a few years, but hey,
you move on.
Some more forest.
Right.
And the forest is burning up at an alarming rate.
Right, right.
Because it's there, and it's cheap to do that.
Right.
It's not cheap to burn down the forest and plant in Norway.
No, it isn't. No, that's right. Yeah. You're addressing the question I hoped we would arrive at the end, and that is motive, isn't it? And you're suggesting that we're shaped by our material circumstances to a great degree.
Well, to a great degree. I mean, there are necessities that we come across here in Norway that they have to address, but it seems to me they're addressing their necessities a lot sooner and a lot more carefully than we are.
Yeah.
We perceive that there is an oil shortage, so what we need to do is open up the Arctic wildlife.
That's right, right, right. Because we don't want to pay more than
that. But conservation is a personal virtue.
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh. So our vice president tells us.
Yeah, yeah.
How about guns in Norway?
Surprisingly, because you know the message seems to be that it's a liberal nation generally, and we connect liberalism here with maybe perhaps the controlling of guns. But in fact, using firearms is such a deep, especially for hunting, is such a deep tradition, deeply rooted tradition in Norway, that it's easy to have a gun, not a handgun, but a hunting gun. It's easy to have
a
rifle, right? So, did you have no?
The home guard take their weapons right to their home.
Yeah, put them in the closet.
You can probably find a pretty high-powered automatic rifle in the closet.
In your neighborhood, right? Yeah, there's an assault rifle nearby. Wherever there's a 19-year-old kid.
That's like Switzerland.
Yeah, right.
Where they take even the jeeps home.
Yeah. Oh, they take the jeeps home.
Yeah. Right.
There were other hands up. I want to get to yes.
Going to remark to what you were saying, that it seems like one of the differences between Norwegian policy and American policy in a lot of cases is the idea of the common good versus the individual good.
That's right.
And which is greater.
That's right. That's the core of the story we're telling here so far, isn't it? I mean, I think at the base what I'm trying to get at is that in this country we live with a kind of runaway individualism. It shapes almost everything we do. We find it difficult to build institutions and coalitions, but the Norwegians do that very naturally and very easily, and that's a huge difference between the two countries. Yeah, go ahead.
Yesterday or a few days ago, you were speculating that this interest in the common weal or welfare of the children, et cetera, kind of began with a labor government prior to the Second War.
Mm-hmm.
Expand on that a little bit?
I think what I was arguing was that since the labor government came in place after the war, this sentiment of common stewardship has become institutionalized. That's what gave us the welfare state in Norway. I don't know how far back it goes historically.
That the inclination to be concerned about your children's the nation's children's welfare preceded that?
I think so. I have a strong feeling so. Although, yeah, I don't know, that's a complicated one. When I read literature about the late 19th century, it seems as though Norwegians are treating their children pretty, you'd say almost harshly. There's a kind of Dickensian quality about Norwegian literature. If you think about Ibsen, for instance, and others, so that's a tough question. I can't answer that one. I don't know enough about Norwegian history to really answer that one. The fact is that there's this strong tradition of protecting the children, environment. I shouldn't exaggerate the environmental stuff. Go ahead.
Well, something I haven't heard you talk about has been that Norway hasn't had a real good economy for a very long period of time. For that matter, a lot of the people through the Sons of Norway have been collecting stamps and sending stamps to Norway, and they claim off and sell them, as for the children was the idea behind that.
It has been a poor, isolated country for many, many years. I don't think Norwegians quite know how to deal with their new wealth. I mean, they've become a wealthy nation in the last 25 years, and I don't think they know quite how to deal with that because it's so new and so different for them, right?
Or maybe they do.
Or maybe they do. Oh, yeah, which is to remain modest and actually, we're about out of time, so I should sew this up. We'll talk with anybody for as long as you want to stick around. But that's tomorrow's issue, actually, is the national tradition of personal modesty. That's enshrined in these laws called the Janteloven. And some of you who are Norwegian American like me are going to feel that your family has shaped you in the same way. Don't think you're too important now. Keep yourself quiet.
I was going to say, one of the things that Norwegians had a terrible time understanding was how big America is.
Oh, yeah. No, they don't.
You know, and when most of them love maps, and I brought the maps over. And Norway fits in the bottom one-third of Montana. That's how bigger it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that was just awful for them to understand that I lived in a state that was, you know, so much bigger.
When I told a friend of mine that I'd be driving out to Washington State, a Norwegian friend, that I'd be driving out to Washington State, he tried to put that in his own terms, and he said, let's see, for me, that'd be like driving to Moscow. Yeah. And then it dawned on him, whoa, that's a big country. Now, and our excuse, if we need one, you know, for not doing as well on many of these things, is that we're an entirely different country. We welcome immigrants. We're changing all the time. It's an entirely different situation. Well, we'll carry that conversation on further next time, those of you who are gracious enough to come again. Thanks for being here today, and I'll talk to you later.